Unlike iron, however, rusting chromium doesn't crumble apart. Instead, it forms an invisibly thin layer that protects the iron underneath. The nickel in stainless steel helps hold this protective layer of chromium rust in place. Remember that chromium and nickel are present throughout stainless steel, not just on the surface. Because of this, the microscopic layer will form itself anew, even when the steel is cut or scratched. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. I'm Don Glass.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedge Row, a special event full-service florist on the corner of University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana. English Hedge Row delivers distinctive bouquets, plants, and gift baskets throughout the Champaign-Urbana area.
In sports, an Olympic official with direct knowledge of the situation says a men's luger from the former Soviet Republic of Georgia has died. After a crash during training, the official tells the Associated Press that the International Olympic Committee received confirmation of the death. The official speaking on condition of anonymity because of the 21-year-old luger's family had not been notified yet. An official statement is to be released soon. The sledder lost control of his unit near the finish today, went over the track wall and struck an unpadded steel pole near the finish line at Whistler Sliding Center. Meanwhile, Lindsey Vonn is getting even more time to let her badly bruised right shin heal. Today's second women's Olympic downhill training run has been canceled, again pushing back Vonn's first chance to truly test her injured leg. Vonn had decided yesterday to participate in the first downhill training session, but that was called off after only two racers. She had been considered a medal contender in all five alpine events, including an overwhelming favorite in the downhill, but that was before she revealed on Wednesday that she was hurt last week in a pre-Olympic practice. Frank Thomas is retiring after a 19-year career in which he hit 521 homers and won two American League MVP awards with the Chicago White Sox. The Big Hurt made the announcement today, but considering he didn't play last season, the news was hardly a shock to many. With his power and ability to hit for high average, Thomas figures to land in the Hall of Fame when he becomes eligible. Thomas is a five-time All-Star who batted .301 overall. He's tied for 18th with Ted Williams and Willie McCovey on baseball's home run list while driving in 1,704 runs. And in an era clouded by performance-enhancing drugs, he was outspoken against their use. The 41-year-old split his final three seasons between Oakland and Toronto, but he will be remembered most for that 16-year run with the White Sox. The Bulls will be represented tonight in the first of the weekend's NBA All-Star events. Taj Gibson is on the squad of rookies for a game against second-year players. And the St. Louis Blues will try to make it two in a row at home as they face the Toronto Maple Leafs tonight. The Blues rallied to beat Detroit in a shootout Tuesday. Tonight they face the team with the worst record in the NHL's Eastern Conference. That's a look at sports.
Our goal is to alleviate hunger in 14 counties in eastern Illinois. In those 14 counties, right now we're serving about 45,000 people per month. There's really new people coming saying, I don't know why I'm here. I've got a job. I ought to be able to feed my family, but I can't. We had been working with WILL on looking at the impact of the changes in the economy here in our community. And that has opened up a lot of doors for us to be able to talk to more people about what we're seeing going on and making better linkages in the communities that we serve. I used to think of it as, I listen to WILL, and now it's like, but wait, WILL listens to us too. That's a very different relationship, a more exciting relationship for us. I'm Andrea Rundell, and I work for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and WILL is my source for community connections.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn today. Valentine's Alert, it is this Sunday, and you have been warned. Few countries have embraced the tradition like Japan, where chocolate giving is a ritual for young and old alike. The Japanese have developed their own particular way of celebrating the day of romance, and that custom is still evolving, as Lucy Kraft reports from Tokyo.
Tokyo Hands, a trendy store in downtown Tokyo, is so jammed on this afternoon, it almost feels like a replay of the Christmas shopping rush. But with one big difference, most of the customers here, browsing under magenta, heart-shaped balloons, are female. Valentine's Day, Japan style, is in full swing. A pair of office clerks in their 20s hover over the hundreds of chocolate products on display. Valentine's Day has always been a Sadie Hawkins ritual in Japan, and these women ponder what to buy their fathers and male co-workers. Another group of friends works the joke candy aisle. It features chocolate shaped like sushi, dried squid, sardines, mayonnaise, and curry. One of the women says, "We're not going in for cute this year. We want something that's a conversation starter." Kaori Shoji is a columnist for the Japan Times and a close observer of Japanese society. She notes how Valentine's Day has traditionally centered on something known as giri choco, or obligation chocolates.
Japanese womanhood is just, like, so nice, and they can't stand to see all these, you know, droopy-faced guys when, you know, the one popular guy is getting all these chocolates. That kind of thing kind of, like, you know, stabs at the consciousness of Japanese women, and so it became like a social event to give obligatory chocolates to the boss, to your friends, you know, to your acquaintances at the office.
Some say Japan's Valentine's Day ritual was dreamed up by the confectionery industry to goose sales during the winter doldrums. If so, Japan and the world's chocolate makers have been successful beyond their wildest dreams, with a huge chunk of chocolate changing hands at this time of year. Kaori Shoji says the holiday provides a face-saving outlet for affection in a country known for its shyness and reserve.
Rumor has it that the girls in junior high started the trend first about 20 years ago. It became one of the ways they can get their confessions out to the boys they like by giving them little gifts of handmade chocolate on Valentine's Day. And then it caught on into this whole commercial venture.
Commercial, it certainly is. At Tokyu Hands, there are model classic cars and tiny golf bags filled with brandy, chocolate-flavored beer, and heart-shaped clocks, bath mats, and bento lunchboxes, to name just a few. A crowd gathers as a store clerk demonstrates how to whip up a gâteau chocolat. The kit makes two cakes, one to give away, one for the baker herself. A Yahoo Japan survey found that about half the respondents are ignoring their male colleagues this year to give chocolates instead to their female friends and colleagues. And a new buzzword has cropped up recently, jibun choco, or me chocolate, says Kaori Shoji.
That's another Japanese phenomenon. Japanese women see themselves as so hardworking, downtrodden, so entitled to a little coddling, pampering once a year. What the hell, you know, we give ourselves chocolate to boost our morale.
Another survey finds that Japanese women are still buying obligation chocolate, spending up to $200 for gifts to the men around them, but as much as $300 on candy for themselves. For NPR News, I'm Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
And also along the Valentine theme, Renee Montaigne talks with NPR's Robert Krulwich and Jada Boomrod from WNYC Radio in New York about a report apropos of Valentine's Day.
With Valentine's Day this Sunday, and don't say we didn't warn you, we decided to tell a little love story today. And this love story is a truly cosmic tale coming to us from our friends at Radiolab.
Hey, Renee.
Hey, that's Jad Abumrad from WNYC.
And this is Robert Krulwich.
So before we get started, a quick reminder, Radiolab.
Radiolab is, to remind you, a show where we get kind of curious, explore ideas, we argue a little bit sometimes.
Right, and sometimes we just like to tell a good story. And Renee, the story we want to tell you today starts with Carl Sagan, you know, the astrophysicist, the science guy.
He was on Johnny Carson over and over and over.
Yeah, that guy. Well, in 1977, NASA asked him to make what was essentially a mixtape of the human experience, you know, put all kinds of different languages, music, all kinds of stuff on this gold record, put the record in the spaceship, shoot it out into space.
Right. This was the Voyager Interstellar Message Project. And the thought being, what, millions of years from now, some aliens might run across the spaceship and find this record?
Somehow learn how to play it and in the process learn about us.
Oh, I thought this was supposed to be a Valentine's story. So far, I'm not hearing the love story.
Well, it's a Valentine's Day story in a roundabout sort of way because the creative director of that project was a woman named Annie Druyan, who Carl Sagan would later marry. And I visited Annie at her home one day, and we sat in the backyard near a waterfall, and she told me about the romantic vision behind the project.
It was a chance to tell something of what life on Earth was like to beings of perhaps 1,000 million years from now. If that didn't raise goosebumps, then you'd have to be made of wood. It was also the season that Carl Sagan and I fell so madly in love with each other. And here we were taking on this mythic challenge and knowing that before it was done, two spacecraft would lift off from the planet Earth, moving at an average speed of 35,000 miles an hour for the next 1,000 million years. And on it would be a kiss, a mother's first words to her newborn baby.
Oh, come on now.
Mozart. Bach. Beethoven. Greetings in the 59 most populous human languages.
Shalom.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
As well as one non-human language, the greetings of the humpback whales. And it was a sacred undertaking because it was saying, we want to be citizens of the cosmos. We want you to know about us.
Tell me about the moment you fell in love with Carl Sagan. You said it was during the Voyager compilation.
It was on June 1st, 1977. I had been looking for some time for that piece of Chinese music that we could put on the Voyager record and not feel like idiots. And I was very excited because I'd finally found a ethnomusicologist, composer at Columbia University, who told me without a moment's hesitation that this piece, Flowing Streams, which was one of the oldest pieces of Chinese music, 2,500 years old, was the piece we should put on the record. So I called Carl, who was traveling, and we had been alone many times during the making of the record and as friends for 3 years. And we'd had these wonderful, soaring conversations, but we had both been completely just professional about everything and as friends. And he wasn't there, left a message. Hour later, phone rings, pick up the phone, and I hear this wonderful voice. And he said, I get back to my hotel room, and I find this message, and it says, Annie called. And I say to myself, why didn't you leave me this message 10 years ago? And my heart completely skipped a beat. I can still remember it so perfectly. And I said, for keeps? And he said, you mean get married? And I said, yes. And we had never kissed. We had never, you know, even had any kind of personal discussion before. We both hung up the phone, and I just screamed out loud. I remember it so well, because it was this great eureka moment. And then the phone rang, and I was thinking, oh, you know, like, and the phone rang, and it was Carl, and he said, I just want to make sure that really happened. We're getting married, right? And I said, yeah, we're getting married. He said, okay, just wanted to make sure. And the spacecraft lifted off on August 20th, and August 22nd, we told everyone involved, and we were together from that moment until his death in 1996 in December.
Wow, talk about romantic, my God.
It was so romantic, and I had asked Carl whether or not it would be possible to compress the impulses in one's brain and nervous system into sound and then put that sound on the record and then think that perhaps the extraterrestrials of the future would be able to reconstitute that data into thought. And he looked at me in beautiful May Day in New York City and said, well, you know, why don't you go do it? Because who knows? You know, who knows what's possible in 1,000 million years? And so my brain waves and REM, every little sound that my body was making was recorded at Bellevue Hospital in New York. This was 2 days after Carl and I declared our love for each other. And so part of what I was feeling in the recording of my brain waves, part of what I was thinking in this meditation was about the wonder of love and of being in love and to know it's on those two spacecraft. Even now, in my whenever I'm down, you know, I'm thinking, and still they move 35,000 miles an hour, leaving our solar system for the great wide-open sea of interstellar space.
Gosh, that is so romantic. I mean, your brain and body in love hurtling through the cosmos for the next billion right. years. Well, Robert,
yeah.
Jed,
yeah.
thank you for sharing that one with
You're
us.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
And that's Jed Abumrad and Robert Krowich sending us a Valentine from the show Radiolab, a production of WNYC.
And that was Renee Montaigne speaking with Robert Krowich and Jed Abumrad. And we want to remind you that coming up, we will have a special opportunity for you to meet Bob McChesney, the host of Media Matters on WILO Radio, as well as John Nichols, and see Media Matters performed live on a Sunday afternoon. It's a week from this Sunday, and it'll be at the Siebel Center right across the street from WILL here in Urbana. Plenty of free parking, and it is a free event, although we ask you to call and reserve a ticket for yourself. You'll also be able to buy a copy of their new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. The new book will be available for $25 and will benefit WILL Radio. And you'll see a live broadcast and be able to participate in the broadcast of Media Matters that afternoon. It all starts at 12:30 on Sunday, February the 21st. And Bob McChesney and John Nichols will be there to talk with you and sign copies of their book following the radio program. In order to reserve your place, call 333-7300. That's 333-7300. And you can look at our website at will.illinois.edu if you'd like more information.
Earth and sky.
The thing about the immune system is it really, every day, it keeps us from succumbing to the microbes in our environment. But it's really heavily armed. And if you can't hit that balance just right, then your immune system is causing problems that can be more threatening than the infectious organism itself.
You're listening to scientist Christine Byron, professor of medical sciences at Brown University. She's talking about the body's immune system, which protects us from disease. Byron studies the role cells called natural killer cells play in our body's immune response. Byron said natural killer cells are components of white blood cells. She described them as the body's first responders.
They really make a difference between health and disease early on. They can help kill